those of you who are on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, if you want to use hashtag the virtual salon and hashtag race and religion, and you can tag me and I'll repost. But just to touch on one thing before I go to Rahma next, because she hasn't had a chance to speak, inshallah, then Sister Amina. But the fact that, you know, I think talking about people of color within the Muslim space, I think a lot of Muslims, of course, there's been the whole people of color line, okay, where basically the idea is that, you know, POC people have aligned, you know, their goals are aligned, right? So we don't have to say black, we don't have to say brown, we can just say people of color and put them all in there. And I think maybe a lot of Muslims feel like, well, we're oppressed too. Like, as Muslims, we're stigmatized, we're oppressed, we're discriminated against, we have laws against us, right? And I feel that there's a lack of understanding about the fact that everyone is privileged in their own space, right? Everybody enjoys a level of privilege, right? And I'm gonna go from, you know, for example, somebody mentioned colorism. And so in certain spaces, lighter skinned black people are privileged, right? I'm going to put my hand up and say that I have niqabi privilege, because in certain spaces, I am more palatable to the community because I wear the niqab. I'm also racially ambiguous, so people don't necessarily know that I'm black. So I'm very aware of my privilege in that sense. Somebody who's educated, no matter their race, they've got a sense of privilege in certain areas. And within the Muslim community, we have Muslim men who enjoy Muslim male privilege. And then we have the dominant Muslim cultures. If it's an Arab community, there's Arab privilege. If it's a Desi community, there's Desi privilege. If it's Gujaratis, you know Gujaratis are on top, right? If you're in a Somali community, you've got Somali privilege, right? So them not, I think that I really want to kind of segue into the conversations that have been taking place within the Muslim community, because there has been what I've seen, like a sense of almost outrage that black Muslims dare align themselves with other black people who are not Muslim, right? And then turn around and point to the community and say, y'all got it too. Y'all racist too, you know? And I think, and I really would like us to talk about that, because I wanna know how you feel about all these conferences, right? And these people jumping on lives and everybody's like, you know, now it's like the thing. So tell me like what your thoughts are, you know, on this issue. So inshallah, I've got Buna's hand up, but I've got to give Rahma her space. I'm sorry, Rahma, if I jumped all over that. I apologize. I just wanted to jump in there, but I'm so sorry. But now I've got lots of hands up. So this is great. I'm coming to y'all.
Okay, JazakAllah khair. I don't have that raised hand, so thank you for getting to me. So I wanted to touch upon a few things that I've heard that really pull me in certain different areas. And I think it's important to acknowledge that we feel differently at different times due to things that are being brought up. So I really resonated with when Muna said, you feel really exhausted, you feel really tired. And some of us have really shoved some of these feelings deep down, so deep that for now, now that everyone wants you to talk about it, it's kind of unpacking a trauma that you weren't ready for. I didn't get ready for this trauma. So getting all this attention, for me, I felt the same way, is I'm having to relive experiences that I've experienced, that I've kind of stuffed down so deep in my soul that I wasn't ready to unpack. And now having to unpack it in front of people and kind of displaying my trauma. People have invited me in certain spaces that have not been safe. And what I mean by that is that these spaces have not included me before. And I have to be really mindful in the spaces that I walk in, because I don't want people to just kind of relish on my trauma. Mm-hmm. Just come display your trauma so that people can get shocked and awe and be, moved to do something. And that's really not what I am about. And it's not safe to do that. So be mindful of that. Other things that have been brought up, and the fact that, you know, Hafsa said, you know, we should be acting. What I want to say about that is that in often spaces where I'm in, especially now, I'm oftentimes, and I will say 99% of the time in certain areas, I'm the only black Muslim hijabi woman. So I don't always have the luxury of not speaking up, because there are injustices and microaggressions that are happening to me on a daily basis. But then again, I do experience exhaustion because I have to make that decision. Is it worth me educating this person? Is there going to be a change because of me saying something? I am in a position where I do work, where I provide essential services and income support for the most vulnerable communities in my province. And I've noticed that me being Black, me being coming from humble beginnings and being an immigrant, I identify with the struggles that they're receiving, and I go above and beyond to provide a service for them, knowing the knowledge that I have. So I might know that they're not able to qualify for this benefit, but I know of other programs, whereas my white counterparts are not doing that. They're answering questions yes or no, and that is it, because they can't identify with that struggle. They don't know when this mother of seven calls and says, I need health benefit, can you help me with this? And I know that all she needs to do is get that extra documentation. I'm able to do that because I sympathize with that, you know, just knowing where I'm coming from. So when Bilqis says that there is no discrimination, like the acknowledging the discrimination and the systematic racism in Canada, it is alive, it is well, it is prominent. You know, just a week ago, our prime minister was asked about that, and there was this iconic 21 seconds of silence on his part, just because he knows his own history of Black faces, where he was called out on that. And he knows that there is a lot of issues in Canada that are happening. I've lived through a lot of traumatic experiences as an immigrant, but I want to really also point out what Bilqis said, is that I am an African woman that came here as a product of immigration. I never want to equate my experiences and my struggles to those that have been brought here unrooted from their countries and that have been struggling for many years before I even got here, where I was flourishing in my country before the war happened. So it's important to acknowledge that, and it's important for me to always know that there yes, I've suffered because of this, but we chose to come here. Like, we fled a war, but we really chose to come here. And I really want that to be acknowledged. And we're having conversation in our own community, because as Somalis, some people don't even identify themselves as being Black. They don't even align themselves with the cause, because we've been told when we were younger that that's not our history. Just because we didn't go through slavery, that it's not our history. So unfortunately, due to miseducation, some of the kids don't even identify themselves as being Black. And I really want to change that narrative.
This subhanAllah, I just wanted, before I go to Brother Buna, I just want to just thank you for that. You know, we've got so lots of comments. Mashallah, just check the comments if you get a chance, because I think, you know, as I said, privilege, right? So even in this situation where as Black people there is systematic racism, systemic racism, anti-Blackness, an immigrant is privileged in the sense that we came from a country, we know where we came from. We know our fathers' names, we know our languages, we know our cultures. And that, I think, personally, I just feel that there is just no comparison. And the kind of things that we will struggle with will be so different. So I just want to thank you for acknowledging that. And the coaches as well, they've also said, Jazakallah khairan, for seeing us, you know, because I think that's really, really important. Anyway, Brother Buna, grab the mic. Bismillah.
Yeah, Jazakumullah khairan. I think the sister brought up a few very good points. And I think specifically from an East African background, my family comes from Ethiopia. I'm Oromo ethnically, which is an ethnic group in Ethiopia. But I mean, when I grew up in Canada, I didn't have any connection with Africa, right? I was born in Canada. I never really associated myself as Ethiopian, as whatever. I was Black. I mean, that was the first thing that I was told. I didn't even get a chance really to decide what my identity was. People just told me I was Black. You know, when I was in school, they used to teach me about Kwanzaa. And I was like, what's Kwanzaa, right? But then that was kind of Black culture that was kind of imposed on us. And in many ways, I think being Black in North America, it's people make us a homogenous group. all of our experiences just for whatever reason get clumped together. But my experiences, like, you know, in relation to this whole conflict around police brutality and everything that's happening in the US right now, my earliest experiences really being Black is dealing with police and the constant harassment I used to get. My first time getting pulled over by the police, I was probably like maybe 11 or 12 years old. I was riding my bike and I got swarmed by three or four police officers who asked me for identification. And mind you, I'm like 12 years old. I don't have identification. I had like a library card or anything. I had like a Blockbuster card back in the day, if you remember what a Blockbuster card is. And from that point onwards, my entire life being scared to death of police. To this day, I'm scared to death. I have this crazy issue with authority figures where I just automatically get very aggressive because I just assume something's going to go bad. And that's been, you know, the vast majority of my experiences for my entire adult life. And it's my experience specifically then, you know, becoming more in tune with my faith and becoming, you know, quote unquote, a practicing Muslim is I haven't really seen a major change. Like, I'm very frustrated, to be honest, with the experience and with the response from the Muslim community, because I see this as all very tokenistic. I don't really appreciate many people's, you know, their hashtags, their black screen pictures, whatever they're doing. Because where were they, you know, before this incident? Where were they this entire time we've been telling them, like, you guys are occupying these Islamic spaces in such a way that you're making us feel unwelcome? How many times have our scholars been rejected for their Islamic knowledge that, are, you know, where we come from is not even seen as valid? When you have a Black Muslim or a person of knowledge who stands up and is ready to lead the salah, how many times have I seen personally uncles who will kind of shush him away and bring somebody else to the forefront, right? For now, everyone to get all inspired and excited to me is like so disingenuous that it feels so cliche and it just feels so cheesy that I don't even buy it. And I know that it's now politically acceptable. This is a very politically acceptable form of resistance. When everybody has already gone to the streets, when everybody's looting, it's okay for you now to post BLM. It's okay. There's no repercussions for you, right? It's, in fact, I would say it's almost mandatory at this point. Like,
it is mandatory, otherwise you're getting canceled.
Yeah, right? Like, I have like Nike and Jordan and, you know, fast food restaurants are sending me a Black Lives Matter thing. I'm like, all right, if they're involved, you must have something to say. I had I'm taking a lot of time, but I just want to say this. I have a masjid that I live close by, and I kid you not, I feel so unwelcome in that space. Every time I go there, I've been going there for years. Nobody says salamu alaykum to me. I walk in. And it's just, you know, it's a bunch of people that I won't say their race or whatever, but that's just the reality. Like, I walk in, they sent me an email saying, we stand with Black people. I said, really? Masha Allah, jazakumullah khairan. I've never seen an iota of positivity towards people outside their ethnic group. So to me, again, this experience has been quite frustrating, seeing the lack of response in the past and all of a sudden this plethora of response. It, to me, it feels like many Muslims are rolling with that same kind of brown guilt, right? Like, they just feel like they've maybe done something wrong in the past. So this is a good way of making amends, but I don't really buy it. And I'm still frustrated by it. And it is very frustrating. And it's also very exhausting to the point where, like, I don't know. That's just my kind of personal experience.
No, 100%. I hear you on that. And somebody just said in the comments, Nora said, it's interesting how some Africans don't identify as Black, but the white supremacist does not discriminate. They see you all the same. So it's best to unite. And no, I definitely feel you on that, Brother Buna, because I think most of us have had, you know, well, I'd like to say well-meaning Muslim organizations reaching out, and mashallah, some people are jumping on the panels and everything. But a sister was chasing down, she had a long list of, you know, like all the leading lights, should I say, of the Black Muslim intelligentsia, scholars, people who could do dawah, creatives, etc. She had a long list of them, and they were trying to reach some people to come for this conference. They wanted to put on a Black Muslim conference where they were going to talk about slavery. They want to talk about, you know, the Islamic view on racism, and a long list. It was very comprehensive. And she reached out to me because she couldn't find anyone to say yes. Right. So these are the, like, you know, the Zayd Shark and Hakeem Quick, like Omar Suleiman, they had everybody on there. Right. And I said to her, when is this conference? And she said, it's next week. I said, oh, right. Okay, so everyone on your list is one of two things, overbooked or exhausted, because we're right in the middle of this right now, okay? So my advice to you is, if you're sincere, put it on in the summer. Have a week of activities or whatever in the summer, right? So you cannot look like all of these crazy people, these influencers and these celebrities and whatever, who are basically just saying, yes, 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 Black Lives Matter to us too. Yes, 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 we're on the right side of history. And I said, if you're sincere, don't do it now. Leave people to do their thing, to sort what they need to sort out, and do it in the summer. I don't know whether that was the right advice, but I said to them, if you're doing it next week, I'm not available, because it just feels like, let's rustle something up. This is a long-term issue. Anyway, I'm going to be quiet. And Michael Momisa hasn't spoken. So, Brother Michael, if you want to take the floor, inshallah.
Yes, I've been... I don't know if you can all hear me.
We can hear you just fine.
I've really been benefiting a lot just by listening. And I just wanted to touch on something that has come up in this conversation, but we haven't had chance to actually focus on it. And it was something we had hoped to discuss. And that is really Muslim responses to resistance against racism, particularly in the form of Black Lives Matter. And I think, because I only have got a few minutes before I go, so I'd just like to say that whenever I'm asked this question, I'm always directing people to the Quran itself. And I'm trying to remind them that the messages that we find from movements like Black Lives Matter are what Islam has always been about, right from its inception. Now, if you read the Quran, you find that one of the most important verses which really codifies Islam's response to issues like this is وَلَقَدْ كَرَّمْنَا بَنِي آدَمْ. We honored Bani Adam, all human beings. And it doesn't make any distinction between whether they are Muslims, whether they are Black or Arab, children of Adam in general, and that they are all honored by God. So racism in itself undermines this fundamental principle of the Quran. So if you really claim to be a Muslim, then you should be responding to this message by supporting those who are fighting against anti-Black racism. And then when you are doing so, you also have to remind yourself that there isn't such a thing as an Islamic response to oppression or Islamic response to white supremacy, because white supremacy doesn't discriminate on the basis of religion. Mm-hmm. And why do I say this? Because when you read the hadith of the Prophet, one of the most famous hadith that people often cite, but often they don't look closely at the wording of this hadith, at least in some versions of it, where the Prophet says, ittaqu da'wat al-madlum, that beware of the dua of the oppressed, right? And it goes on to say, wa in kana kafiran, even though the oppressed may be disbelievers. And in another version, wa in kana fajiran, even though they may be sinners. Fa innahu laysa baynaha wa baynallahi hijabun, because there isn't any barrier between that prayer and God. God answers directly. So this, I think, is one of the most important principles in how we respond to oppression. I think to remind ourselves that the fact that a movement may be dominated by people who are not Muslims doesn't necessarily mean that it is not Islamic. It really is doing exactly, at least for the Muslims who are part of the Black Lives Matter, they are really continuing with the Sunnah of the Prophet, the Sunnah of standing up against oppression and of course challenging anti-Black racism in particular. And I think a lot of people have already touched on a number of things here. Really, another question really is about whether one can be Black and Muslim at the same time. I think we all know it's really not a relevant question, because right from its beginning, Islam was already a religion that cannot be separated from being Black or being African. The first hijrah was in Africa. So Muslims were already in Ethiopia before they were in Medina. And there were a lot of children who were born in Medina, and the Prophet himself, when the Sahabas came from a lot of people, children were born in Habasha, in Abyssinia. And when they came back to the Prophet after the Hijrah, they were speaking only Ethiopian dialects. And in one of the narrations, I think Ammat bin Khalid, she says that this Prophet spoke to me in the Ethiopian dialect, which means the Prophet understood this. It's not surprising that the Prophet would understand these languages because he was brought up by a Black woman and he was surrounded by Black people. And so this has been the history of Islam right from the beginning, that you cannot separate it from Black people. Even the tools that we often use we weaponize these tools against Black Muslims. We try to quote or we try to engage in some kind of racist tafsir. The tools of tafsir themselves could not exist without the contribution of Black scholars. One of the most important schools of tafsir, or the earliest movement of tafsir, the Makan School of Tafsir, which was made up mostly of the students of Ibn Abbas. It originated with five scholars. Five scholars were regarded as the pioneers of this particular school of tafsir, and four of them were Black Africans. And one of them was a Persian, and all of them were mawali. It means on the margins of society. We wouldn't have Bukhari or Abu Hanifa or Ahmad bin Hanbal without these Black scholars, without Atha ibn Abi Rabah, for example. And so this is part of the forgotten memory, or the memory that people choose to forget because they want to advance racist positions and racist narratives. And even when you look at those, I'll conclude with this few points. I don't want to take too much of your time. I think I'm simply talking about this because this hasn't been addressed in terms of how we respond to racist Muslims who try to silence Black resistance against oppression because they themselves are beneficiaries of the status quo. So I think what Black Muslims are doing in challenging white supremacy is exactly what the Prophet would have done. And it is even when they walk side by side with movements like Black Lives Matter, because the Prophet, the Quran, when you read the Quran, you read Hadith, you see that there is no distinction whatsoever being made between the oppressed Muslim and the oppressed non-Muslim. Their dua is answered even when they are non-Muslims, even when they are sinners. And then also you see that scholars like Ibn Jawzi, Asuyuti and others addressed these issues. The questions we're talking about now are not new. They have been addressed by early Muslim scholars. The issue of anti-Blackness in Muslim communities has existed right from the time of the Prophet, and the Prophet tried to fight against it, but it survived, of course, like a disease that it is, the disease of Iman, rather it is a virus that infects people's Iman. And scholars, one of the earliest scholars being Al-Jahid, who wrote a book against this, and many others wrote after him. Then Ibn Jawzi wrote a book about it, and he went on to talk about it. Students of Hadith, those who study Hadith, knows that there's a principle in the analysis of Hadith. One of the ways of identifying if a Hadith has been fabricated is when that Hadith is attacking Black people. That became a principle in the study of Hadith because there were so many Hadith being produced by racist Muslims trying to discredit the contribution that Muslims had made in the development and the spread of Islam. As early as the 9th century, you already had people producing dodgy traditions and trying to attribute them to the Prophet. The Prophet said this about Black women, the Prophet said this about Black people, and Ibn Jawzi comes and says, oh, these traditions, you don't even have to bother looking at the chain of transmission. You just have to throw them in the dustbin because they cannot be attributed to the Prophet. So that became a principle in the study of Hadith. It's one of the principles that you look at when you're studying, when you're verifying Hadith. So the history of Islam itself, whether it is fiqh, whether it is Hadith, whether it is tafsir, could not exist without Black scholars. Anyone who has done Islamic studies knows that if they really studied properly. And we wouldn't have any of the scholars we admire today, Al-Ghazali, Al-Shafi'i, and all of them. And I'll just conclude by saying Ibn Khaldun, that people like to quote so much. They like to quote Ibn Khaldun a lot in other subjects, but he wrote in his Muqaddimah that the the branches of what which we are, rather the tool that we now use, one of the tools we use in understanding the Quran or Hadith, that is the tools to do with what we call, you know, the language in general, whether it's balagha and grammar, could not exist without the contribution of Al-Jahid and his student Al-Mubarrad and Ibn Qutayba, among the four who are listed as the founders of what we now take for granted is the tools you need in the study of fiqh, in the study of tafsir, in the study of hadith. So really, Muslim, Black Muslims today, and I think they simply stand in a long line of Muslims who have come before them. And when they respond to racism, they're again doing what Sumaya did when she stood up to the Quraysh, and also what all the other Sahabas we know of did. And it wasn't just Bilal, there were so many others. And of course, Bilal has become some kind of mascot for racist Muslims. So there were so many other Sahabas who did that. And of course, the Tabi'in, and it carried on up to our time. And that's all I have to say on this matter.
Oof, thank you. Jazakallah khairan. As some people would say, like, facts. And the chat is really active. Please do take a moment to check the chat. SubhanAllah, so much of our own history that we don't know, that we've had, you know, we've had rewritten. Okay, so I'm going to go with Muhammad, and then the coaches, and then Imani, inshallah. Go ahead, Brother Muhammad.
Yeah, I'm gonna give you a few examples. I'm talking about how Asian and Arab Muslims in the community who are the pioneers of driving this sort of anti-Black racism that Muslims now are experiencing. And it may sound harsh, but this is not only is it the experience of myself and even as someone who benefits from, you know, the elements of colorism and being a light-skinned Somali living in the UK, even in that light, I'm still too Black for them. I'm still experiencing those direct forms of racism. And if I look at the platform that we created, Black and Muslim in Britain, that we created in 2016 and then finally launched it in 2017, I get regular emails, direct messages on my personal social media accounts or the Black and Muslim in Britain pages, where people are saying Black and Muslim in Britain is dividing the Ummah. If you identify as Black, you're disuniting the Ummah. And I'm saying, we have these events like Blackout Eid and Blackout Iftars and all these kind of events. Those programming only came about due to the experience of Black Muslims experience racism in those communities. When I have the recent study in the UK, and it's been out for about 3 months, and no Muslim organization has picked it up, that a sister from Black Muslim Forum did a report that covered the cases of 100 self-identified Black Muslims. And the results came out as 53% of Black Muslims felt that they did not belong to their local community. 64% felt that they did not belong to the Muslim community. It's 84% felt that they had no engagement or no relationship with the university's Islamic society. And 36% experienced anti-Black discrimination and colorism within their families. 79% face anti-Black discrimination in the wider community. And when we hear these numbers, that's resonated through people's stories, whether it's in America or the UK. And if it's not, and I think Nadira Pierre tweeted about it, and it was funny as well as very, very sadly true, that the only Muslims in the diaspora who are asked, are you Black or Muslim first, is Black Muslims. No one asks Asian Muslims, are you Asian first or are you Indian first or are you Muslim first? No one asks Arabs, are you Saudi first or are you Muslim first? And that's solely because of the color of your skin. And I think from the point of like exhaustion and education, I think this is kind of where I was going with. I'm specifically talking to non-Black Muslims, so other people of color, in terms of, we've been doing work for a long time on racism. We've been doing it for a long time. We've done a lot of education. I'm a young activist. I'm only 29, but I've been active in my community for the last 11 years. And 11 years is nothing compared to my elders in the community who've been active on cases of countering anti-racism, and they're exhausted. And I'm 10 years in and I'm done. I can't keep receiving messages privately where people are saying that we are disuniting the Ummah. It's absurd, this kind of like colorblind idea of Islam. Islam was never colorblind. The Prophet ﷺ in his final sermon recognized that there is no difference between the Arab and the non-Arab. There's no difference between the white and the black, you know? Islam has always recognized color as a unifying factor. It's never been a divisive factor. So for when I say I want to organize an online video series where we share the dialogue of the experiences of being black and Muslim in Britain, that's all it is. We are sharing that experience with the wider world. We're sharing that experience with the wider community. So to be told that those kind of projects and platforms are disuniting the Ummah, and not recognizing that that's only been caused by those oppressors within the Muslim communities, the gatekeepers in the UK, with the Muslim communities predominantly of the South Asian background, and other cases in America, I don't know what the numbers are there. You know, there's only so much we can do. Like we can give you resources, but at the same time, you know what? I think that's going to have to turn into some sort of consultancy of how to overcome the racism that exists in your community. Because it's not a new point. We raise this point constantly. And you know what? We won't stop. So I'm not that negative. And we will continue to give our, you know, understanding and knowledge of our own experiences. But you have to put in work in yourself.
Yeah.
You can't just come around in Black History Month and hit me up with an email saying,
"That's it! That's it! Oh.
We want to do a poetry night and we want to have all the Black Muslims." I'm like, cool. Make sure you do another program for Black Muslims outside of Black History Month, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm just hoping that, I'm hopeful that maybe we can change. But in this current state, in this current climate, and the work that already exists in the UK in particular on anti-Blackness, that wider Muslim community, the gatekeepers have a lot of work to do. And we have receipts. Mm-hmm. We have receipts for days on our experiences. Yeah. And we can pull that up as much as we can, but people have to realize that they need to make changes within themselves. This is commanded in our religion. This change comes from yourself as well.
Yeah.
Sorry, I've been rambling. I'm going to stop because there's other amazing voices I would like to hear as well. Sorry.
No, Jazakallah khairan. So thank you so much for that. And, you know, to your point, at the end of the day, where there is, you know, where there are privileged, dominant cultures or majorities, there's always going to be underprivileged. Yeah, the ones who are, as I said in one of my lives, if you look at the Black Muslim situation and you parallel it with Muslims who have disabilities, that intersection of being Muslim and having a disability, right, means that as a Muslim, you have certain priorities, but also as somebody who is disabled and a minority in your faith community, you have another set of priorities. And the thing is that we see this as well as sisters. We've got a lot of sisters on this panel, mashallah. In fact, somebody on Facebook, when they saw the poster, that was her comment. So many women, mashallah. And y'all know what I'm talking about. But the point is that, you know, and again, this gives me hope because I know that 5 years ago, 10 years ago, there were no sisters speaking at all, let alone avatars on a poster, right? There were no even avatars on a poster. They weren't on the marquee. They were not on the program. And that's changed. And the number of spaces that are either women led or have invited and welcomed women to speak, that has definitely been a shift in the community, and may Allah make it only for khair. Similarly, you're seeing some people being more aware of a male-only panel, or a Pakistani-only panel, or Asian-only panel, you know? I think we've kind of gone a bit further when it comes to gender than we have with race. But I think that this moment, inshallah, will mean that people become aware of their privilege and aware of the fact that, hold on, we're not necessarily being as representative of the true community as we think we are. Because like you said, you know, a lot of this thing about being Black, I think it comes from Muslims thinking that Black culture is not Islamic or is not Muslim. Not realizing that Somalis are Black functionally. you know, Ethiopians are Black. Nigerians, black, Ghanaians, black, Tanzanians, Kenyans. And these are Muslim cultures from way back, from hundreds of years ago, right? So because you didn't know that actually Islam in Africa is almost, is as old as, almost as old as the deen itself, if we go back to, you know, the first hijra, right? As the brother Michael said. So that kind of, it's a disconnect almost. It's like Arab, you know, Islam is for Arabs and Asians. And that's what I thought when I first found out about Islam. I thought this religion is for Arabs and Asians, you know, it's not for black people. It's not for Africans, not knowing that, you know, the majority of Saharan and maybe half sub-Saharan Africa has had an Islamic tradition going way, 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 way back, subhanAllah. So anyway, I don't want to talk too much, inshallah. So, but jazakallah khairan for your point. I think it's super, super relevant. I'm going to go to Amina next. Then we've got the coaches, then Imani, then Buna. Please remember your order, guys, because I can't remember it. Okay, so Amina, go ahead, sis. Where is she?
There's a quote that at 43 years old, I'm living by, you know, it's to go where you're celebrated and not tolerated. So for me, doing things like this, like I'm when you say you're tired, I don't want to be used as a token. You're not going to use me as a pawn and you're, and to make, to be a self-serving, to make you feel better, to make yourself sleep better at night, to make your masjid look like they're doing the work. So for me, I would rather use my energy in spaces like this. I would rather use my energy, my creativity to write books like Bashir and the Amazing Bean Pie, to put on plays with organizations who see us and they want to amplify our voices. You know, so for me, and I think that for all of us, I think that we're, at least for me, I can only speak for myself, that I'm over trying to be, accept me or love me. Like, that's not my history as a Muslim, you know, as being 43 year Muslim, is that to do for myself, to celebrate your community and to love those, and to surround yourself with love, so that way your iman is not weakened, because there's a little chip that takes a part of you when you go someplace. And it's happened to me recently. Like 2 days ago, I was in the supermarket and I said, Assalamu alaikum, like, even though I had a mask on, but I was waving. And as soon as she saw my face in my hand, she went, rolled eyes and looked away. And I didn't know her. I just was happy to see another Muslim. So for me, that it agitates that hurt. It agitates that pain. And I would rather to use that, my energy, to be in spaces like this, to be celebrated and not tolerated. And I will not be used as a pawn, or in your to make yourself feel good. So for me, I create things that are going to be accepted by people who are already woke. You know, I do things that are going to be receptive. Like the company that I started, Haught in Muslim, is Islamic based, you know, branding, like T-shirts and wall art and mugs. And those are things that, make dua and go for it, sis. So we see that and we like, oh, I know what that means. And you don't have to, you know, explain it to someone, you know? So there's a mug that I have which says, I am the answer to the dua of my ancestor, dua of my ancestors.
I love that one.
What does that really mean? Because it was the silhouette of Africa. And I was like, you know, I don't have the time. I explained it to her, but it was like, those who got it, get it, you know? And so that's where I am presently, is that I'm going to use, you know, inshallah, I'm going to serve my creator. I'm going to love my religion. I'm going to surround myself with love. And I won't allow my iman to be weakened because of ignorance and, in their own personal issues. Like, that's your issue. Don't put that on me. Like, your faith is not strong. That's your problem, you know? So, you know, so for me, listen, when Naima said, we're going to have a talk, boom, I'm there. But if your masjid has been historically gaslighted your community. It's a historical, you know, no, I won't speak. No, don't ask me. I will give you information to read, you know, from organizations like Muslim ARC, Muslims Against Anti-Racism, you know, Coalition. So, but for me, that's not what I'm going to use my energy to do, inshallah. And I'll end with that.
May Allah preserve your energy and always just increase your energy and barakah. I mean, girl, you know, we go way back. Ah, mashallah. Who's next? Who did I say next? Was it Imani or was it the coaches? Was it the coaches? Okay. Thank you for that. Jazakallah khair. And here you go.
Oh, yeah. Alhamdulillah. It's so crazy because everything that the speakers have been saying is like so on point. I'm like, yes, yes. And I'm like, and that part, and that part. Because, yeah, I get being tired. You know, we don't have to explain ourselves to anybody. Like, we don't have to explain how we feel. We don't have to explain these things. We don't. But for some reason, we seem like we're obligated to. We're obligated to educate. We're obligated. They have the same information that we do. I mean, the thing is, yes, we can point them somewhere, but like Amina said, the energy. My energy can be best used on something else. Between us, it's 12 children we have to raise and like that. That's where the energy goes, where if you're doing it right there, it's going to, inshallah, spread out everywhere else. So the thing is, but our community is different from other communities that I've seen traveling, where, like we said at the beginning, Jim Crow North is what it's called, where our Black masjid, you know, it's like it's one where you see the Black people at, and then the other ones, not so much. So, you know, and when I actually lived on that side of town and frequented that masjid on that before all the other ones kind of came to be, it was the part of seeing me like I don't belong because of the color of my skin. It's really difficult when you have a child that's going to a Muslim school. That when they're treated a certain way, it's different if they're going to a different type of school and it's not, you know, they're not Muslim. You say, oh, well, they're not Muslim. You know, you get that excuse. Well, they're not Muslim.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But when they're in a Muslim school and they're being treated the same way by people that either look like them or share la ilaha illallah, and what do you say then? You know, what do you can't say, well, they're not Muslim. You know, so
I think next week we are going to be discussing that issue, inshallah, at length, because I think it's a whole topic in itself about raising Black children in today's world. So I hope, inshallah, you'll be able to come for that. But it's a huge issue. That particular one about school and the Islamic school and the experience of Black children in the Islamic school
So that's a whole different beast there. And then my bonus baby, she did a talk yesterday and she was talking about the talk that she was called to do. And it made me think of what Bona said, where he's like, okay, are you just calling me to speak on these things? Because, you know, now this is now it's a novelty now. Now it's like, hey, this is what's going on. This is what's in the media. Who's our token Black guy? You know, who's our token
Black guy? Who's the one on the Rolodex?
Right. And so that was the thing, and she said one of her friends, and I was like, oh, hold up, let's be careful who we call our friend. When you're looking at something and say, you know what, I was watching something on slavery, and I thought of you. Wait, okay, hold up, what is that supposed to mean? You know, so it's certain things where it's definitely time to call it out and say, okay, sometimes people are just ignorant, you know, and ignorant means you just don't know. But sometimes the people are just stupid. And when it comes down to it, you can't fix stupid. But the thing is that you call it what it is first. You know, you call it what it is so they can see what it is. Because sometimes they don't see. I get that. I understand that. But just like Amina said, that's not my, you know, my energy can be used somewhere else. But I am going to get you to, I'm going to hold the mirror up to your face. You know, and I think that's what I'm seeing the shift. And especially when it comes to even the race and Muslim dynamic, where it's like, hey, this is what it's looking like. Because the way our city is set up is very, very racist. It's very, very segregated. And I remember, I'm going to say the Black Masjid had an event of what was going on as far as like police brutality and different stuff like that. And they invited different members from the other masjid around to be a part of it. Sat at the same table with a number of them. I was like, oh my gosh, I did not know it was like this, you know, because we're seeing so much stuff with the media giving this narrative. And it's like, oh my gosh, I know this person. I know this person is not like them. You know, that's kind of that thing. Oh, you're not like them. What is that supposed to mean? That's another thing that the racist comments that they don't realize is actually a racist comment. So, you know, you have to say, okay, what does that mean? But then you find out, it's like, oh, okay, now the narrative is, you know, the media is creating this, it's, you know, and we are allowing this by not getting to know one another, by keeping it separate, by keeping it segregated and things like that. Or to say, you know what, I remember stating, I saw something where it showed that it said Muslims are racist or something about Muslims being racist. And I didn't like the title because I said, that's stating that there's not Black Muslims. You know, when the person talked about it, he talked about, well, you know, what happened to George Floyd, would you have, well, you're talking about Black Lives Matter and different things now, but would you have allowed him to marry your daughter or anything like that? I'm like, okay, well, you're not talking about a Black Muslim then, because I'm pretty sure Black Muslims would say, you know what, you know, that wouldn't be an issue. So when you're stating Muslims as a whole, they're Black Muslims here. And that doesn't mean that they're part of the nation, you know? And that was the thing that I had to learn before I converted to Islam, that, oh, okay, you know, the nation of Islam and Islam are two totally different things, you know, when they say, and it's actually Black Muslims who are, you know, who practice Islam. So it's a totally different thing, but it is that education. But just as much as I wanted to be educated on it, and I worked on being educated, people have to want to be educated. People have to want to know what it is, and they have to sincerely want to help and sincerely want to be a part of it and sincerely want to say, you know what, this is not my fight to be in the forefront of, so I'm going to step back, but you let me know what you need me to do in order to support you. But I need to step back and let you do your part and help you do your part, so people know that this is about you and about what you're going through. And it was like what you were saying, Naima, where people say, well, we've had problems too. We're discriminated too. Yeah, okay, we understand that. But right now, this is what we're talking about. Yeah. We're not saying, somebody said something about, somebody did an article said, all buildings matter, put an all buildings matter quote. And they got a lot of backlash for it. And it's like, oh, that's not what we meant. We're so sorry. And this and that, whatever. It was okay, so don't say that, because just, we understand that, you know, you don't want to destroy things and everything like that, but don't put certain things in the way of the real message. Nobody's saying, when they say Black Lives Matter, they're not saying only Black Lives Matter. We're saying that Black Lives Matter, so pay attention. Black Lives Matter, so make sure that you are they are being inclusive. You're not being excluded. But right now, with your privilege and all the stuff that you've had all these hundreds of years, step back. Because right now is our time.
Yeah. And I think, sister, to your point, the very fact that phrase Black Lives Matter is even a thing to say is indicative of the whole problem, you know? And even the fact that there is pushback against that kind of statement shows really kind of it's indicative of the state of affairs. And the fact that, you know, people are, you know, getting their children to wear t-shirts saying, you know, don't shoot me, you know, stop killing us and things like that. That for me is just, you know, profoundly shocking. But I want to go to Imani and then Buna and then Muna, inshallah. And I just want to thank everybody who, has been here this whole time, our wonderful panelists, our amazing, you know, guys who are just here listening, you know, just soaking up the energy of everybody. I just ask Allah to bless every one of you and to allow us, you know, to feel that sakina, inshallah, and to be part of the change that we want to see. So all of you who are here, please, I want you to know, I appreciate you being here and being such an amazing, you know, space. And to all the panelists as well who've been here, I think almost 2 hours now, mashallah. Jazakallah khairan. Go ahead, take it away, May.
I just wanted to speak to assimilation. And I think when a lot of non-Black Muslims come to the United States, they weigh their options. Where am I going to be? Who do I see as being most accepted? Who do I see as being most celebrated? Who do I see that's in the least trouble? And that's white people. And they want to find that adjacency to whiteness as opposed to allying themselves with Blackness, because Blackness is always oppressed. Blackness is always terrorized. Blackness is always the bottom rung of every society. No matter what culture you go to around the world, every culture has some derogatory term for Black or Blackness. And so therefore, non-Black Muslims will come to the United States of America, and they can ask someone like me, who's four generations deep of Islam, you know what your name means? Or are you Muslim, even though you're fully covered? Or as Amina has stated, you know, and I will assert the fact that my first overt, and when I say overt, I don't mean in terms of like socioeconomics or the education system or things that are obviously blatant to keep systems against and oppress Black people. But my first acts of overt anti-Blackness and racism was in the masjid. I met that in the masjid, to give salams and somebody acts like they ain't never heard you, for somebody to roll their eyes as though you don't have the right to be in Allah's house, for someone to literally be standing in prayer, and when you stand next to them, they move. These are things that I encountered at a very young age before I even experienced my first anti-Blackness or racism from a white person. These things happen in the masjid. So for me, when I equate racism and anti-Blackness, I typically draw that back to my experiences that I had in what it is that we would call in Allah's house. And unfortunately, like I said, a lot of people want to align themselves with whiteness. I don't follow a lot of non-Black Muslim women for that particular purpose. I feel like a lot of people have come to the point in their Islam, especially with social media, where they costume their hijab, they make these hijab lines, they make all of this money, then all of a sudden you see them in two years, oh, I'm no longer wearing hijab. I remember, and let me firstly state, hijab is a personal thing, and I do not judge any sister who feels like they need to remove their kimar and get themselves together spiritually. So let me put that disclaimer out there. I have been there. But when you costume your hijab and you make money off of people and you use it, I'm a hijabi this, I'm a hijabi that, and then you openly state, which I have seen multiple times, that I have done this because it is easier for me to blend in and I don't want to have to deal with the things that come with that. I cannot costume my hijab as a Black Muslim woman. My hijab is literally a generational revolutionary act of my identity. My grandparents, Yahya and Sakina, had to go to court in the United States of America to fight to keep their names because they did not understand how two Black American people had names like Yahya Bashir and Sakina Bashir. They had to fight to keep their identity. So when I put a hijab, a kimar on, or put this cloth on my neck, it is a revolutionary act of my identity. So when I see non-Black Muslim sisters feeling like, oh, well, I can just blend in, I don't see sisterhood in that. I don't see Islam in that. I don't see Ummah in that. You're telling me that you're no longer aligning yourself with me as the oppressed. You're telling me that you no longer align with me as your sister. You're no longer telling me that you're willing to do this thing that can stand up to represent us all. I make it a point that when I go to anywhere in the world, I remember I was going to Paris directly after the quote unquote terrorist attacks. And people were telling me, sister, don't wear your hijab down, wear it like a turban, whatever the case may be. And I remember going there, and as soon as I got off the train, I took the train from the UK, and I saw Muslim sisters from China with their hijabs down. And I said, how dare anybody run away from this dean when there are so many people around the world who need them to stand in their dean, to stand in this faith, to stand in these principles that Allah has given us. People also forget when they come to the United States, 70%, and anybody can research it, you can Google it, 70% of the Black African people that were forcefully brought over here from the transatlantic slave trade identified as Muslims. If you go in the African American History Museum in Washington, D.C., they have vicar beads from the transatlantic slave trade, from African slave enslaved people. They have Qur'ans that date all the way back to the transatlantic slave trade. I wrote an article about Black African people who, in order to keep their identity, fasted during slavery. They would give their food to others that were also enslaved, who were not Muslim or who were not fasting, but they would take the food so that the slave masters would not know that they were fasting, because they didn't obviously want them to know that they were keeping their Islamic identity, but they would give it to somebody else. These are the things that generationally that I have had to continue to fight for, my father, my mother, my grandparents. And so when I see people posture themselves as though they are somehow better, or they think that if they speak Arabic, I'm not going to understand, and then I respond to them and then they're surprised, like, wait, you knew what I was talking about? Because I was talking mess about you and you wasn't supposed to know. So now I have to try to find a way to rectify it. Like, oh, no, sister, I did not mean that. And a lot of people too, and let's put it out there, especially in the United States of America. Sorry, I keep talking about the US. I know we got our British folks in here. Shout out to y'all. Shout out to our Canadians. But a lot of people didn't even recognize that they were of a different ethnicity or racial group, or even recognize their Islam until 9/11 happened. It was like, wait, I'm not white? In our census forms and on our like applications, in where it says white, where you check the box, it says white. It literally had in parentheses Middle East. I think it had Asian or some type of Asian or whatever. And people legitimately thought they were white. Syrians thought that they were white. Egyptians still think that they're white, but thought that they were white. And so when 9/11 happened and people were getting their hijab snatched, something that Black Muslim women have had to deal with our whole lives, then all of a sudden it became like, what? When people named Mahmoud were saying, no, call me Mike instead, I am still going by Imani. My father is still going by Muhammad. We are still identifying who it is that we are, because no matter what we do to assimilate, we are still Black. And that's the thing that I feel like goes unscathed in this community. It gets brushed under the rug in this community. I know I can only speak to British people, because I have family in Southall in London, East African. My sister-in-law is Somali. And so I know this happens in Britain as well. I know that this happens in the UK as well. And I know that a lot of non-Black Muslim people got their money and got their riches off the back of Black African people, and still will turn around and turn their nose up at them. So I just want to state that assimilation is one of the biggest problems that we have in the non-Black Muslim community.
Are you saying that it's that proximity to whiteness, that ability almost to pass, I guess? It's like a Muslim version of passing for white, and having access because of your features and because of your skin, that you could be just ethnically ambiguous, the exotic look. I guess you have access to that, right?
Absolutely. And if I feel that I have some adjacency to that, and people won't necessarily view me as bad as Black or people of color, because people of color is a trend. Let's be clear. People, to say I'm a person of color is now a trend, as opposed to an actual identity that people believe. I don't know when people started calling themselves brown in the United States of America, but I just started hearing that maybe like 2 or 3 years ago. That's very new. So people really had this adjacency as much to whiteness as possible, because that is the positivity. Oh, we have to go to Harvard and Yale. We have to be the doctors and the lawyers and the things that are seen by white dominant society as success. And so if I align myself with that, I am successful, leaving everything that Allah has told us creates success. And one of those main things is siding with the oppressed, fighting for the oppressed, standing up for the oppressed.
SubhanAllah. Oof, hey, big facts, big facts, big facts. Okay, Buna, okay, can I give it to Brother Abdul Wahid, guys? Please, can you hold Buna and Muna, since Brother Abdul Wahid hasn't spoken yet? Bismillah, take the mic. Sure.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say thank you, Naima, for inviting me. And there's been some of you, I know you, some of the work you're doing has been amazing. I've been following you. Some of you, you're new, especially some of the brothers and sisters in the States. Basically, I just really want to echo a couple of things that have been mentioned by Obeid and Michael and Muna and Imani. But before I do that, I'm not going to hide from the fact that I'm the first person in this whole panel. And what happens is in the community, yes, a lot of times when people find out that my mom's Jamaican and my dad's English, like, oh, I thought you was Algerian or Moroccan, and they come out with that type of statement. But people that know me, that grew up with me, primary school and stuff like that, they know, for example, I was raised by a strong Jamaican woman and this is my background. To me, that's not relevant. I think what I want to, it's not relevant with regards to today. And why I say that, because when Imani mentioned this, I can't breathe, that really, really, really touched me a lot. And the reason why I said, I think it was Imani, no, it was Muna that mentioned it. Excuse me, Muna. She mentioned I can't breathe. That's how she opened her what she was speaking about. And that touched me for two reasons. We're at the end, we're in a pandemic. And this pandemic, how it kills you is that you can't breathe. It slows down your breathing. And we know people that have died. I personally was involved in burying a young boy that died in the UK as a result of this pandemic. And our dua goes out to everyone that's lost somebody as a result of COVID. The problem is now there's data that's come out to show it's more prevalent in the ethnic community. So now you started to wonder, hold on a minute, why is that? Is this a result of discrimination? Or so this is one thing. The second thing is the statement of, you know, George Floyd. It was, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. And that's become kind of like the slogan of what's, you know, what this movement's about, the injustice, and secondly, the accountability, you know. So this, you know, the statement, again, my condolences go out to the family and the relatives, because they've watched that video and they have to repeatedly see that video. And that is a very difficult thing to do, you know, to see your son or to see your brother or to see get murdered, basically, by the people that are charged with protecting and upholding justice to be the murderers and killers. That's a difficult thing to do. So my condolences go out to them first, you know, first and foremost. Well, what I want to touch on, and I'm going to try to be quick, because I know there's a lot of, it's been like 2 hours and stuff, is first of all, Obeid, which is, you know, your young boy, Naima, may Allah preserve him and give him, you know, success in his studies and stuff, studying sociology. He spoke about change, and I'm with him. I believe that this is going to lead to a change, and that's already started to happen. I think today in the news, they've said that they're going to ban chokeholds in America, in the police, in the precinct where this happened. So there's going to be transformation and change. And that's possible because of two things, because discrimination is not something which is in your biology, it's something which is a social structure, basically. So as long as it's something which is a behavior, then it can be changed. Like now, post-COVID, everyone has to change the way they behave. Inshallah, I'm hoping, and there's a lot of positive indications towards it, that post, you know, after these protests die down, they're going to die down, they're not going to last forever, there are going to be policy changes which is going to have an impact of some sort. But, and I'm saying this but, with regards to discrimination, racism, these things, this is a force of evil that's existed since, as I think it was Imani mentioned, discrimination. From the beginning of time, we're talking about Iblis. Iblis, he discriminated and he wouldn't follow the orders, he wouldn't follow authority based upon discrimination, when he said that ana khayrun minhu, I'm better than him. He considered himself superior, and that's the arrogance and the pride, and that's the discrimination we're speaking about. So with regards to the change, even though there'll be change, there's always going to have to be a group of people, and this is from our teachings in Islam. behavior, there's always going to, the heaviest thing on scale of these Yom L'Qiyama is your behavior. And Islam doesn't distinguish or discriminate between people based upon gender or color or race. So everyone knows that. That's not something which is new information. It's about your taqwa, your level of God consciousness, your closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, your actions, your ibadah. There's no discrimination in Islam. That's not something which I think is a question. But I think what the point is that the education and the people that are going to stand up against discrimination or other or racism or wrongdoings and stuff like that, that has to always happen. Our Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam led the way in that. There's many countless examples. I've got quotes, but I don't want to, you know, take more time. And there always has to be a group of people that are going to be doing that. And I think the transformation that we've seen as a result of this incident specifically, the Floyd murder, is that there's this shift which has been, there's been a call and a campaign for this shift for a long time, but everyone's ignored it, which is a move away from saying, oh, hold on a minute, I'm not racist, I'm innocent of racism myself as an individual, to actually combating racism and standing up against racism. So becoming, for example, an anti-racist, it's not enough just to say I'm racist. No, I'm anti-racist. I'm against racism. And I think this is a bit of a shift that it took the tragedy of a murder, public murder of a police officer for this to happen. But inshallah, I'm hopeful that this is the shift, the positive shift that you're going to see. But with regards to, and another point which I think I want to just echo, because there's nothing for me to add, there's so much positive and so much learning that's come out of this. But another point I want to echo, and you know, he really made a lot of valuable contributions, is Michael, who's obviously a professor, he's a scholar. There's a lot of statements saying imams don't speak up, and imams need to address racism. And there's pointing fingers and blaming. And I think as a Muslim community, as well as a Black Muslim community, then it's counterproductive. What I mean is that people do things in different ways. Okay, the imami does something in one way. The author, he or she does something in another way. The person that's raising these events is, but just because at that particular moment he doesn't say the right thing doesn't necessitate, for example, that he's not doing anything. This is, I think, a misconception. What Michael highlighted is that scholarship and Islam and the transmission of hadith and the transmission of the Arabic language and the transmission of Tafsir al-Quran, it came through who? Black scholars, Black imams that were either freed slaves. Their social status got elevated through knowledge and through education. And I think this is something which needs to be highlighted. A lot of times the verse is always quoted about diversity in Islam. The verse that Allah mentions, I'm just going to mention the English, we created you for male and females and made you nations and tribes so that you may know one another. Verily, the best of you is the one that has the most taqwa. This, to highlight diversity and the lack of discrimination in Islam. And that the disattaining factor is actually taqwa, knowledge, behavior.
Yeah.
I think what's commonly not known is the reasons why this verse was revealed, asbab al-nuzul. And there's some of the reasons. And if you look at the reasons, you're going to find that it's the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam in an incident where there was discrimination based upon someone's either level of their poverty or because of their race. And this discrimination was either in a situation of marriage or in a situation of appointing and giving a person of color, a Black person, whether it's Bilal or other than him, a position which the nobles at that time thought, hold on a minute, why is it him and not one of us type of thing? So the point is that discrimination is there, but it's not genetic, it's not DNA, it's social. And it changes through the transformation that of enjoying good and forbidden evil. As we all know as Muslims, a verse, let there arise from you a nation or a group of people that they enjoin the good and that they forbid the evil. Yeah. This is essential for the establishment of justice and to remove injustice. And this is what Islam is about. It's about establishing justice and accountability. And this is, inshallah, I think one of the, like Obeidi mentioned, there's going to be a change And I think that change is going to move away from being people. It's not acceptable to just say, oh, I'm not racist because I've got black friends. How can I be racist? No, you have to be anti-racist. You have to be overtly against racism because it exists in this, in your sphere and your friendships and your society, even if you yourself may not claim to be racist. I think the funniest thing that came out of it, and I'll close with this, is, you know, one of the Donald Trump's advisors saying he's the least racist person in the world. Donald Trump, you see what I mean? So this is the type of situation I think we have to, you know, the transformation that may come. And inshallah, I hope, I've been trying to speak, but maybe I didn't get in at the right time. So that's it, really.
Jazakallah khair, and thank you so much, Imam. And I'm sorry I didn't see your hand going up. And yeah, then I, mashallah, one of the audience members actually messaged me privately and said, I think Brother Abdulwahid, we wanted to speak for a while. So there's him, and also Obaid has been wanting to speak for a while as well. But just to, before we go to Buna and then Muna, and then if Obaid still wants to speak, just what you said about racism not being genetic, I think that's, although it sounds obvious, I do think that there is some kind of programming that we have that, you know, people of whoever are like predisposed to look down on black people. And, you know, this whole thing that somebody else was mentioning, I think it was you, Habib, about, you know, this, it's now like a construct that black is always at the bottom. Enjoyed this conversation and you would like to become part of the virtual salon family, consider becoming a patron. From just £5 a month, you can get access to our chat community, to be invited to our live sessions, and get exclusive content that we only create for our patrons. Be part of the movement. Sign up on Patreon today.